Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're just about 54 minutes away from that rate decision, which of course is expected to be no change in rates at all. Chairman Powell and company expected to leave them unchanged, probably talk about the flexibility they have to continue to do so and watch as the data comes in, as they consider the policies coming from the Trump administration, inclusive, of course, of tariffs. This was a subject that the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, just got a lot of questions about in his testimony before the House Financial Services Committee, of course, his second day in a row on Capitol Hill this week, answering questions about this, what it would do to costs for consumers, baby products, for example, but also the state of negotiations with different countries. Remembering we heard from the secretary in his testimony yesterday that negotiations had not yet, in fact, begun with China in particular, which currently has 125% retaliatory tariff on all U.S. goods because the U.S. has 145% tariff on Chinese goods. But those conversations will begin shortly. We heard about it from the Treasury Secretary himself previewing what's to come in Switzerland this evening.
I will be going to Switzerland, and the negotiations will begin on Saturday. The trade negotiations will be led by myself and Ambassador Jameson Greer, and USTR.
What about Pete Navarro?
Sorry?
Peter Navarro.
He will not be joining us in Geneva.
So the Treasury Secretary and the U.S. Trade Representative, not Trade Advisor at the White House, Peter Navarro, planning for talks in Switzerland this weekend, not this evening, as I said a moment ago. But we want to get more on that and the rest of the Treasury Secretary's testimony and turn now to Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall, Washington correspondent, who is live outside the committee room on Capitol Hill. Tyler, a lot went down in the last few hours.
Yeah, Kaylee, and in fact, we couldn't have timed this more perfectly because the Treasury Secretary is actually walking out right now. Mr. Bessent, Mr. Secretary, will you lower Chinese tariffs this
weekend during negotiations?
Thanks very much, guys. All right, well, that was one of our tries, one of our big leading questions here as we wait to see what potentially could come out of those negotiations as they do head to Geneva over the weekend. As you mentioned and played that saw, Peter Navarro not expected to be in those talks. When it comes, though, broadly speaking about these trade negotiations, the Treasury Secretary did say that we could still expect to see some sort of principle agreements in principle, as he called them, as soon as this week, and that they would later paper those deals over in the months ahead to make them fully fledged agreements. We have yet to get any update from the White House on when those potentially could be coming. Sticking with China, though, it was interesting because he said that the Treasury was working with legislators on outbound investment rules for China that would make it clear what's allowed in and what's not. He said it would basically amount to a red light, green light system to be used as a national security tool in order to restrict China from allegedly exploiting American capital. Quickly, I would also like to add, Kaylee, that when asked directly, when it came from China to actually Russia, when asked directly if he thought that Vladimir Putin was a war criminal, he answered in the affirmative, yes, but that ultimately you do need to negotiate with both sides. That is the nature of diplomacy in order to get a deal done. I will also add, of course, we can't talk about this administration's economic policies without also pointing to the tax cuts and the reconciliation package. Treasury Secretary Bessent, perhaps one of his more contentious exchanges with one Democratic congressman, did say that he thinks the deficit to GDP ratio will stabilize and go down over time if this reconciliation package passes. But when pressed by that congressman, he did say that long-term debt will likely go up if the bill passes, but if GDP goes up faster, then it wouldn't really matter. He did affirm that the U.S. will always meet its debt obligations and did not give us an update on a potential X date, instead saying that it's a moving target. Of course, as you well know, we have been watching that very closely because that's considered to be that sort of hard deadline when it comes to things on when these lawmakers are going to have to pass that reconciliation package in order to lift the debt ceiling.
And Tyler, just quickly on that, Secretary Bessent will also be partaking in another one of the so-called Big Six meetings on reconciliation today. Do we expect today to be a day of real progress?
At this point, we haven't really seen much progress, and I can tell you behind me, you actually might be able to see it. There is a dual hearing going on in the Energy and Commerce Committee, and they are trying to figure out exactly how to shift through the debate when it comes to potentially Medicaid cuts. That is one of the biggest litmus tests here, if you will, that Republicans really do have to find. We even saw that House Speaker Mike Johnson recently said that the $880 billion target over 10 years is likely very ambitious. As of now, Kaylee, we're tracking that they're negotiating potentially work requirements, but how expansive that would be remains to be seen.
All right, Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall live on Capitol Hill and trying her best to get one more answer out of the Treasury Secretary after his hours of testimony. Thank you so much, here live on Bloomberg TV and radio. And joining us now also from Capitol Hill, but instead of the committee hearing room, from the rotunda is Republican Congressman Greg Murphy of North Carolina, who happens to be a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is also meeting on reconciliation today. Congressman, you're very kind to step out for us, as I know there were some important conversations happening between you and your colleagues on the committee earlier. Can you give us any insight as to whether or not tangible progress has been made, particularly on the issue of the SALT cap?
Yeah, you know, well, Chairman Smith has sworn us to secrecy, but I will tell you that we've been making definite progress really over the last 3 or 4 weeks, if not several months, on trying to get a solid package. Obviously, SALT is very concerning to some of the members, where you have California and New York, which have insane taxes on their citizens. We're trying to put something into a package that will help alleviate some of the tax burden that they have. That said, you know, Kaylee, the bottom line is we have to worry about our debt. And as the Secretary said, our debt to GDP ratio really right now is killing us. So when we bring all these discussions together, we have to worry about one singular thing. It is the singular focus on our debt. And we're trying to have pro-growth tax policies to grow that GDP, to make sure that it is higher than our debt ratio. And so we try to grow ourselves really into a place of stability.
Well, Congressman, I understand the chairman may not want you to reveal too many details, but he, in fact, spoke with my colleague Julie Fine yesterday and suggested that when it comes to SALT particularly, everyone is going to end up unhappy with whatever compromise is made. With the way things are tracking now in conversation, do you expect there will be more unhappiness from some of those blue state SALT caucus members or those who don't think the SALT cap should be materially lifted?
Well, I think it is a tension. It is a battle. We're worrying about our deficit, but those members in California, New York, the high tax states, really do want some relief. Yeah, everybody's probably going to be proportionally unhappy as we move forward with this, but that's what would happen with all the tax packages. There are going to be some winners and some losers, but they're all going to be winners and losers in some regard.
And Congressman, as you were just alluding to the Treasury Secretary's testimony around the debt to GDP ratio specifically, which he said is something that even the former Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen watched rather than the sheer level of the deficit. When he was pushed under questioning if that deficit number itself was likely to go higher, he did say yes. And I wonder if that is an acceptable outcome to you as a Republican.
Well, we want the bottom line is we want the American economy to be able to, the American government to be able to repay its debts. That's the bottom line. It really doesn't matter specifically on numbers. The real crux of the matter is, can we pay back our debts? And if we're growing our economy greater than we're producing a deficit, that is the goal. That is the goal itself. So real numbers themselves are great, but you really look at ratios as to really what the most important factor is.
Well, and of course, spending has to factor into this as well, specifically where spending cuts have been identified or will be identified. And Congressman, I don't have to tell you, as we just heard from my colleague Tyler, Medicaid is very much in question in this argument. This is something that the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York spoke to us about here on Bloomberg yesterday. And this is what he said about Medicaid cuts in particular.
We ask them, give us specific examples of waste when they're cutting Medicaid. And they fail to come up with them or have one anecdotal thing that can't even be proven. We know that they want to slash Medicaid, not because of waste, but for one reason, and that is to give tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. You know, God bless the people who made a lot of money, but they don't need a tax break, certainly when you're cutting Medicaid, which is going to cause huge layoffs, decline in health care, and closure of hospitals and nursing homes.
And of course, sir, you are not just a sitting congressman. You are also a medical doctor. And it's with that in mind that I ask you about this, considering we got new figures from the Congressional Budget Office in response to a question asked by Democrats about some of the various proposals that could be put forward here. They estimated, the CBO estimated, that capping federal spending in states that have expanded Medicaid, which hasn't been ruled out by the speaker, would lead to 3.3 million people being booted off their coverage. Is that something you would support?
Well, first of all, Chuck Schumer is being false. He's being absolutely wrong in what he's stating. I can give you, I'm a practicing physician, I can give you many examples of waste and fraud that's going on in the Medicaid system. So he doesn't know what he's talking about. Second of all, you know, Republicans are destined, and this is what our plan is, still to raise Medicaid probably by about close to 25% over the next decade. We have to get to a system, and if you're going to pick one word for this administration, it's called accountability. And any business person, anybody who's looking at this program, understands you can't run a business and you can't run a government without accountability. This Medicaid system has been a system that has been abused, used, fixed, and taken advantage of in so many different quarters. And it is okay, it is absolutely the right thing to do, to look at this system and make sure that it works for the people that is intended to work for, those who are eligible for Medicaid. So Chuck Schumer, you know, shouting out those nonsense lies is really not helping the situation. Good Lord, I've been a physician for 35 years and I've taken care of really the most desperate of individuals. The last thing I want to do is not take care of individuals, but we have to be able to pay for it at the bottom, at the end of the day.
Well, and so to kind of come back to my original question, Congressman, if there are indeed millions of people who are booted from Medicaid rolls as a result of this legislation, is that an acceptable outcome?
So if you look at what's happened with the expansion population, we had people that left being insured by companies to go be insured by the federal government. If it means getting them back on insurance by companies and getting them off the federal dole, that's not losing health care, that's taking it off the federal books. But in as far as people being kicked off health care, et cetera, those are scare tactics. We're literally trying to save a program for those who are eligible for it while trying to take the benefits truly who don't deserve them.
All right, Congressman, we appreciate your time. As always, Congressman and Dr. Greg Murphy of North Carolina joining us here on Balance of Power on Bloomberg TV and radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We are live in Washington, paying attention to the reconciliation debate on Capitol Hill, a Federal Reserve rate decision that is coming just over 40 minutes from now, of course, expected to be no change in rates, but also what is happening in geopolitics after we have seen some serious escalation between nuclear powers India and Pakistan in recent days. Of course, in the aftermath of an attack on Kashmir back in April, India then striking into Pakistan yesterday, saying that it was only targeting non-civilian targets. Pakistan disputing that. And Pakistan's premier, actually, in fact, just within the last 30 minutes or so, has said India must face the consequences of those strikes. So we want to get the latest on this situation and turn to Courtney McBride, Bloomberg national security reporter, who is here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. So, Courtney, obviously the tensions between India and Pakistan, nothing necessarily new here, but we haven't seen this kind of military activity in arguably over 25 years. Is this likely to escalate further?
It's really anyone's guess. There's certainly some escalatory rhetoric coming from both sides, but it really remains to be seen. Pakistan has vowed to retaliate in a time, place, and manner of its choosing. But, you know, we have been here before. In 2019, they came pretty close, it seemed, to all-out war. There was also a shoot-down, a capturing of an Indian pilot by Pakistan. Ultimately, they did step back from the brink, and that's certainly the hope this time as well.
What role does the U.S. play in trying to pull everyone back from the brink here? Do they have any role to play in this particular instance?
Well, certainly the U.S. has relationships with both countries. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, in his capacity as acting national security advisor, did speak with both of his counterparts in that acting role and urge them to urge India and Pakistan to talk directly and to work to defuse the situation.
Yeah. Now, National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, in addition to everything else he currently has to juggle. This also comes, Courtney, after J.D. Vance just spent several days in India. His visit was primarily focused on trade and trying to reach a trade deal, but it did happen in the aftermath of this attack back in April that, of course, originated this current bout of tensions. Do we have a sense of what the Vice President and Modi talked about when it comes to Pakistan and how it might be shaping the way in which this is all playing out?
I mean, our understanding, you know, obviously any bilateral visit and conversation has a variety of components, but that, as you said, that visit was much more focused on the economic relationship between the two countries. You know, we do have some reporting today on some of the challenges to India's rise economically that are posed just by this ongoing tension with its neighbor. There's a question of instability that certainly can play a role.
Well, especially considering these are nuclear-armed countries
yes.
that we're talking about. No one anticipates, Courtney, that this would ever escalate to a level where the use of those weapons are actually in question, right?
Correct. But, you know, that is an added complication and something that has to be taken into consideration anytime these two neighbors are at odds.
All right, Courtney McBride, who covers national security for us here at Bloomberg, thank you so much for joining me. As always, again, we're juggling a lot of stories here on Balance of Power today, from what's happening abroad, how the U.S. is playing a role, to what's happening here at home, and conversations on Capitol Hill, also conversations with our trading partners about our economic relationships. And all of that could factor in ultimately to the health of the U.S. economy and what happens going forward with both growth and inflation. Having just heard from the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent testifying before the House Financial Services Committee saying that the Fed should be focusing on both sides of its dual mandate, prices and its employment goals, the Treasury Secretary saying the two are inexorably linked. And of course, that's what the Fed has to consider as it gets ready to send this rate decision down about 38 minutes from now. So for more on this, we turn to Liz Pancotti, joining me here on Bloomberg TV and radio. She's Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Groundwork Collaborative. Liz, welcome back to Bloomberg. As we consider not just the decision itself, because I think we know that's not going to be where the news is if they don't do anything with rates as expected, but the press conference we're going to get from the chairman shortly thereafter. How hard is this line going to be to walk for Chairman Powell, who is under pressure from the president to cut rates and have to explain to the journalists who are going to question him and to the American people why they are or are not ready to think about doing that yet?
I think Jay Powell has become somewhat of a tightrope walker acrobat over the last really few years, but particularly in the last few months. And so I suspect we'll see him show those same attributes. I think what's really going to be notable in this week's FOMC kind of sense making is that last FOMC meeting, we saw them really just go up right to the line of hinting at stagflation, of slow growth, increasing unemployment, and increasing prices. And nothing since 6 weeks ago has gotten really better. We've gotten new data out showing really slowed growth. We've gotten a jobs report that was a little bit hard to make sense of, but certainly we are seeing weakening in the labor market. And we got an inflation print that still shows extremely sticky prices, and combined that with the kind of policy outlook with a trade war, or really many trade wars all at the same time, threatening both the labor market and prices and ultimately growth, I think we will see the Fed sort of hint even more at stagflation this afternoon.
Well, if the hint is going to be stagflation, knowing that in theory monetary policy would step in if there were signs of an outright recession, Liz, when do you expect those signs to materialize? And knowing that the Fed wants to wait to have hard data in hand, isn't just looking at the soft data, can they actually act in a timely enough manner to avert a recession in its entirety, or can they only act to bring us out of one if it occurs?
I think the question is actually, what can their actions do to avoid a recession at all? If you do have economic conditions where prices are increasing, growth is slowing, and unemployment is rising, the Fed has really one blunt instrument to be able to change the macroeconomic picture. So it feels a little bit like we have a Phillips screw and a flathead screwdriver with this conundrum. So I think the question is not necessarily when will the Fed start to act, but really if the Fed acts, will it do anything to actually soften the blow of this economic calamity that the president has really created on his own?
Well, and when we consider the president's own words about what could happen economically, he seems to be talking a lot, Liz, about what will happen through the lens of children's dolls, the availability of them, whether kids will be able to get as many and how much they will cost. But I do wonder, if it's not dolls, where you expect within the economy these shortages and potentially either empty shelves or higher prices for items that are shelved will start showing up in a more material way. How close are we to that moment, considering what we're seeing in cargo volumes coming over from China?
Yeah, I mean, we at the Port of LA, we are now at a 50% reduction year over year. Just last week, Gene Sirica, the head of the LA port, was saying 35%. So the picture is grim. JP Morgan is expecting 70 to 80% declines in shipments from China. You know, I think the president was kind of making an offhand comment when he said that the children might have two dolls instead of 30. And what he might want to turn his attention to is, you know, the doll makers have said all of the hair for those dolls comes from China. And so it's not how many dolls they'll have, but if they'll be bald. But I think in a more serious note, you know, 98% of car seats, 97% of strollers, 90% of first aid kits all come from China. These are essentials that parents cannot go without. And as we head into the summer season, more than 90% of charcoal grills and fireworks come from China. As these businesses kind of, you know, we saw in the trade imbalance data earlier today that there was a massive spike in imports kind of leading up to Liberation Day. These businesses are rapidly spending through their inventories so that they don't have to pay the tariff on new shipments. Eventually, they will run out of those inventories, and families across the country could see essentials not on shelf for them to be able to purchase pretty soon here. I'd say for most businesses, they typically have between 2 and 4 months worth of stock supplied. Maybe some larger businesses were able to stretch that to about 6, but there's only so much stockpiling you can do.
Well, and as the Fed has said repeatedly, and as you were alluding to earlier, Liz, there's not much the Fed can do to address supply shortages. Their ability to impact the supply and demand dynamics is focused solely on the demand side. And I wonder, as we consider the interest rate mechanism and its abilities to influence demand, if actually what we could see is consumers themselves balking in the face of higher prices, bringing their own demand and consumption capacity down, and in some sense actually making it easier for the Federal Reserve if it's consumers that bring their own demand down, making the Fed not necessarily need to have tighter policy. Does that make sense?
It's possible. I mean, we've seen this a little bit from some of the fast food earnings reports out last week. You know, McDonald's, Chipotle are all reporting decreases. We'll see Disney this week. But by and large, I think consumers and businesses are like really trying to put as many big decisions on ice as possible. We don't know what the president will announce tomorrow, if it'll be 1,045% tariffs on China or 0% tariffs on China. It is really hard as a consumer to make a decision about large purchases. Do I buy a car now because I expect that the prices will only continue to go up and my car might be on the verge of breaking down? But you had Ford announce large increases in their prices. As families are planning, you know, vacations for this summer, they're rethinking, is now really the right time to spend a couple $1,000s, or should we wait it out and see what happens with our jobs or with our expenses? And as businesses are considering hiring decisions, they're, you know, really thinking about, should I add a full-time employee right now, or can I make do with the staff I have? So I really think what we're going to see is largely an economy on ice. And the question is, as that ice melts, is the economy spoiling or flourishing? And I think it really remains to be seen, and the president's actions will have a large effect on those. And it's not totally clear what's coming out of this White House. You know, the president alleges that there's hundreds of deals he could announce, but he's not announcing any. I know Treasury Secretary Bessent and USTR Jameson Greer are traveling to Switzerland this weekend to meet with the Chinese. I'm not sure how much we can expect movement there. And so I really think it depends on how the president keeps course on his erratic trade agenda as to what happens with American consumers and businesses.
All right, Liz, we just have a minute left here, but if you had the chance to ask Chairman Powell a question at the press conference today, what would he need to answer for?
I think the better question to ask him is about his Grateful Dead fanfare. But I think what I'd really want to know the answer is, if faced with increasing unemployment and increasing prices, what tools are in the bottom of the depths of the toolbox of the Fed to make sure that American families do not pay the price of this president's erratic economic agenda? And I'm not sure he has an answer for that.
All right. Well, we'll see if he gets asked a variation of that question this afternoon. All the same, Liz, thank you so much for joining me. Liz Pancotti is Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Groundwork Collaborative.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.